Live like you mean it.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking tasers tonight. They are the hot new stun gun of choice. They are transforming policing in America. Legal now in every state but New Jersey. Tasers are now used by a third of all police departments. Police say they save lives. Critics say they can also kill and worry that they invite abuse. Tonight on Point, taser mania. But first, the Democrats are coming, is the word on the street in Boston. The Democratic National Convention kicks off in the city Monday. John Kerry is scheduled to get the nod on Thursday. The delegates, journalists, and bigwigs are already beginning to descend. Reporter Artie Cornish is covering the convention for On Point and WBUR. I asked her, is Boston ready?
Well, if you ask the city and local host committee organizers, they would say yes. If you ask residents and commuters, they might say no. Because this is the first convention since September 11th and since the terrorist attacks, and because it's the first ever political convention in Boston, people are very, very anxious. Just today, the FBI issued a warning about potential domestic acts of violence against media vehicles. And so these are all new things for the city of Boston. The media isn't used to potentially being targets. We're not used to the idea of thousands of protesters coming to the area, and we're not used to the idea of 40 miles of highway being closed to prepare for the event.
Tell us about that. Security has been an enormous theme around the preparation for this convention.
The Secret Service has designated this a national security event, which means that they've come in and made suggestions as well. They've been here for a year or two making suggestions and working with the local police. And as a result of their suggestions and the plans by the city, like I said, there are 40 miles of highway being closed. There's all kinds.
Including the major artery to the middle of downtown Boston.
I mean, part of the issue for Boston is that the place where it's being held, the Fleet Center, is a sports arena that is right sort of in the center of the coastline of the city. Which means that it is in very close proximity to a major highway, Interstate 93. It's very close to the airport. It's right near the harbor. It's right near City Hall. It's right near John Kerry's house on Beacon Hill. And so there are so many different aspects and different kinds of places that normally you'd have to think very hard about securing on their own in proximity to each other.
So how have they gone about laying down the scheme of security over all that central city area?
Well, the attitude has been to really, A, clear the area. So many city blocks nearby will be closed. Already, if you went out there today, there were Jersey barriers up and no parking signs here and there, really just clearing out city blocks. And those areas will be closed during convention week. Specifically, the area directly around the Fleet Center is what's called the hard security zone. That means you're getting security sweeps, your bags are being checked. And then in the blocks surrounding that are considered the soft zone. This is an area where obviously the public can travel, but our sort of being discouraged not to do so, and where there will be very high levels of security and police officers out visible in that area.
Sounds like the daily life of Boston is going to be pretty significantly disrupted next week.
The city is just not used to this kind of disruption. I think that it's been a real surprise, a real eye-opener, a little bit of buyer's remorse for the residents in the area, because when the convention first came, it was, this is going to be an economic boom. This is going to sort of vault Boston into the next level of being a convention city.
Limelight.
Exactly. And there's a convention center that was just recently built. So the idea was this was really going to launch us to another level. And some people are wondering, you know, was it worth it?
Well, commuter trains not even coming into town. We hear about people taking the whole week off and just staying out of town. On the other hand, the political fever is rising. The people will be gathering. What kind of influx is on its way to Boston?
5,000, just under 5,000 delegates are on the way. And so they'll be hitting all the different hotels over the next few days. And then there's something like 15,000 media. And we say media because it's not just, you know, reporters, it's cameramen and producers and all these support people coming as well. They're also going to be flooding hotels in the area. And it's that influx of of people that is putting a little stress on the system. I know cab drivers have been mixed about how they think, what kind of business they think they're going to do that week.
Tough to get around.
Tough to get around, but maybe if there aren't a lot of people on the road, as the city is suggesting that people not be, maybe it'll be clear rides.
And as you mentioned, John Kerry's home, only a few blocks from the arena on Beacon Hill in Boston. How's the political path look for John Kerry as he heads into town?
It looks pretty smooth, and that is the idea. Throughout this process, the Boston media has been extremely focused on the convention. I know some of the convention organizers have said, you know, it's usually not like this, but we've been really focused on it. And for them, the idea is, you know, you just make a nice, soft nest for the candidate to land.
This is the Democratic Party's dream for John Kerry at the convention.
Yes, and he is supposed to be the center of attention. So while the rest of us may be going on and on about traffic and security and things like that, the idea is that this thing go off without a hitch. And I think that will happen. There was definitely some tension over the last few weeks because there has been labor unrest in the city. The police union was without a contract over the last few days and had been picketing different events. They were picketing outside or doing informational pickets, they're called, around the Fleet Center, which actually delayed the overhaul of that center into the convention for 2 days.
Now that's been settled.
They're still talking about doing
some picketing.
Definitely. They're threatening to picket the welcoming parties for delegations. They've even hinted at possibly being around at the night when Kerry is supposed to accept the nomination. We noticed that national labor leaders are starting to step in now and say that will not happen. And so it's been a mixed bag here in Boston politically. At times, the mayor has even said sort of disparaging things about the Kerry campaign in his frustration with what's going on here. But I think that people are ready for the convention to come. They just maybe wish that it wasn't quite so disruptive.
A lot of planning in the party is about to begin. Audie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Audie Cornish is a reporter for WBUR in Boston. She will be part of our team as we broadcast live from the Democratic Convention Monday through Thursday next week. In 1969, an Arizona inventor named John Culver created the Taser, a stun gun that uses an electric current to incapacitate a target. The name stands for Thomas A. Swift Electric Rifle, a nod to the Tom Swift of science fiction fame. Versions of the Taser technology have been used since the 70s, but since 1999, when the pistol-style M26 Taser was introduced, sales have boomed among police departments in the United States and abroad. Today, about 100,000 officers nationally have Tasers, 20 times the number on the street in 2000. Taser fans in blue say they are a great non-lethal alternative to the gun and save lives on both sides of the badge. Critics fear they may not be so non-lethal. 50 people have now reportedly died after being zapped with a Taser. And human rights groups worry that the promise of a non-lethal but very tough solution may invite abuse. Tonight on Point, Tasers and the use and misuse of non-lethal police force. Are you happy that police now have a debilitating weapon shy of a gun? In a pinch, isn't it better to tase than shoot? Or are tasers an invitation to abuse of power of civil liberties? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Orlando, Florida, is Dave Ogden, a lieutenant in the training division of the Orange County, Florida Sheriff's Office and head of that office's committee reviewing the use of tasers. Dave Ogden, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom, for inviting me. How are you doing this evening?
Just great. Wonderful to have you. Also joining us from St. Louis is David Klinger, professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. He is a former police officer with the LAPD and in Redmond, Washington, and is author of Into the Kill Zone, A Cop's Eye View of Deadly Force. Good evening and welcome, David Klinger.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to both of you. Dave Ogden, to you first. There's been some controversy, I guess, over tasers in your part of the world. We read that, in general, police departments around Orange County have agreed to restrict their use of taser stun guns. Your department has not. How are they being used down there, and what's the debate?
Currently, right now, the sheriff of Orange County, which is Sheriff Kevin Barry, actually has conducted a committee, which I'm heading the committee about 2 months ago, and we're looking into all those things. We're looking into reviewing our policy. our procedures, our training, pretty much everything that surrounds the tasers right now.
And what has led to this review of taser use, Dave Ogden?
I'll be honest with you, pretty much the news media. It seems like we have had three in-custody deaths here, which have not been attributed to the taser itself. But because of those deaths, there has been some interest in it. So, the sheriff down here figured it was a good time for us to take a look, actually sit down and review all our policies and procedures, which actually we do every year.
In the case of those three deaths, had tasers been used before the death?
Correct. Yes, sir. They have been used. But it's really important to know, through the history of law enforcement, in-custody deaths have occurred. They will continue to occur. And the fact that we are using tasers now, you're going to see in-custody deaths when you're using tasers as well. It's not going to change from the past to today.
Dave Ogden, in general, how do police officers, how have they used tasers in your department and in neighboring departments? What kind of situation?
I think it's been very successful. As a matter of fact, in the Orange County Sheriff's Office last year, we documented 561 uses of taser. Now, that might sound like a knot, but it's really important to note that we had 32,000 arrests last year. So the statistical data is really insignificant. It's just over 1%. Majority of tasers that are being used, most of the time, are being used at an aggressive physical resistance level and higher. Last year, for example, we used tasers 18 times when we could have used deadly force and shot somebody. Now, that's not to say that taser should not replace a weapon by all means. It doesn't, and it shouldn't. But by proper training, good tactics, and everything else, you can actually reduce the amount of shootings that you're having or the potential of those deadly force situations. So law enforcement's pretty much behind the tasers.
And is it your experience there in Florida that the use of tasers has reduced the number of deaths from police deadly force?
Again, is there any way you can say that? I think we have. The first year and a half that we implemented the tasers, we put about 250 on the street. And basically what you saw is there was a commensurate number of increase as we increased the tasers, so our use of force documentation went up. So you have some people saying, well, you use more force. That's completely inaccurate, and that's misleading using our data there. What's happened is we're documenting a lot better now, so the documentation is there because you use a taser in situations you wouldn't have. So, therefore, the use of force stats appear to go up. But they're not. Until we establish a flatline base for about 3 years, then we can really start accurately analyzing the data. But what we're seeing, I think, is that the data is showing that it is showing rise. Over the last 3.5 years, we could have used deadly force on 40 occasions, and we haven't done so. The first year and a half we implemented them, we actually did a study, our human resource division, and what we found out is that there was an 80% reduction in officer injuries that were directly related to arrest situations and nearly 50% for suspect injuries. So it's a very positive situation for us.
David Klinger in St. Louis, jump in with us here. It sounds like right across the country, police departments have the same kind of feeling as Dave Ogden. They're really high on tasers and happy to have them, and yet there's this fringe of controversy. What's going on?
Well, I think it's really two things, and I think sometimes people seem to be talking past each other. I don't think that anyone can make a cogent argument that the taser is not a life-saving device. I would doubt that in all 18 of the cases where the lieutenant was talking about that the officers would, in fact, have employed deadly force, they probably would have been able to resolve it short of that without the taser. But in some number of those cases, I'm pretty sure that officers would have, in fact, used deadly force. So if what we have is we have a situation where some number of shootings are averted and some number of those shootings citizens would have died, clearly it's a life-saving tool. What happens is other people tend to look not at that angle but look at the lower levels of force where officers might be using a taser against an individual who really doesn't present any sort of major league threat. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is I believe we're seeing a shakeout across the country where law enforcement understands that the taser is a good device. Most city managers, mayors, so on and so forth, understand that also. The concern seems to be when you've got somebody who is not behaving in a highly aggressive manner, but maybe someone who's passively resisting. By that, I simply mean officer says, get up, the person says no, and the officer pops him with a taser. And some agencies are allowing officers to use the taser at that lower level, and that creates the concern that maybe officers are overusing it.
We're going to look at exactly that and more. David Klinger, Dave Ogden, please stand by. We're talking tonight about tasers and the use and misuse of non-lethal police force. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you happy the police now have a debilitating weapon shy of a gun in a pinch? Is it better to tase than shoot? Or are you worried that the taser will be misused? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Wood or thermalite and silk or sheer panels from around the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about tasers, the stun gun, and the use and misuse of non-lethal police force. You can join our conversation tonight. Police officers, have you ever used a taser? Why? And with what effect? Citizens, have you ever been tased? Why? How did it feel? Was it fair and reasonable use? Is it too tempting to use a powerful weapon that does not kill, or is this just what we need for American police forces? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by David Klinger, professor of criminology at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, and from Orlando, Florida, by Dave Ogden, a lieutenant in the training division of the Orange County, Florida Sheriff's Office. Dave Ogden, let me ask you, I know lots of police officers in the process of being sold the tasers, they are zapped themselves to see how it feels. Have you been zapped?
Yes, sir, I had. Matter of fact, in the year 2000, when we were getting introduced to the tasers, the factory was down here. I was one of the first individuals to be zapped, and in the agency, we've had several hundred individuals that have done so.
I know that typically they only give the police officer a very brief zap, probably briefer than a suspect might get, but what did it feel like?
Usually it's about 1 second or so. I took a 4 or 5 seconds on air. There's no doubt it's very debilitating. I was shot in the hip area, in the lower leg area. And to me, it kind of felt like your legs cramped up. You couldn't move any longer. But it definitely stopped me from doing whatever it was I was about to do, and also, therefore, somebody could have subdued me.
Do people fall down when they're hit with a taser blast?
Yes, they do. Matter of fact, usually they tense up, they fall to the ground, and then you can secure them once they're down on the ground.
And how long are they typically debilitated?
Well, that's the thing, and it really depends. Every individual is different, and you'll see, you'll hear some concerns about multiple tasing. Some individuals, if you're angry enough, and if the mind will be, you will fight through something like this. You might not fight through the actual activation, but the second it's done, you can jump up and start running. And that's the thing about the taser. There's no after effects or anything else whatsoever. So an individual who maybe is high strung or doesn't or just wants to fight, it might take them down for that time period, but they're going to get right back up afterwards, and that's why we have developed tactics around that situation.
So they're down while the prongs are in, the wires are attached, and the voltage is flowing, but when that stops, they could hypothetically or do get up and go.
Correct, and as a matter of fact, that's what happens a lot of the time. So we implement what we call a five-second window of opportunity. If that happens and the suspect happens to exhibits some sign that he just really wants to fight, there'll be a subsequent activation, and during that activation, the officers will go hands-on and actually handcuff the suspect. Therefore, they don't have to deliver any more voltage.
Dave Ogden, we appreciate the first-hand account and appreciate your joining us tonight. Thanks so much for coming on.
No problem, Tom. You take care. Thank you.
Dave Ogden, lieutenant in the Orange County, Florida Sheriff's Office. I'm joined now from New York by William Schultz. He's executive director of Amnesty International USA. Good evening and welcome, William Schultz.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening.
Good evening. Good to have you. Your group has been watching the popularity of tasers right across the country and has begun to raise some significant concerns. What are those, William Schultz?
Well, let me make it very clear that Amnesty International is not opposed to the use of tasers in theory. We recognize what Professor Klinger and others have said, that there may be instances in which their use can indeed be a preferable alternative to the use of lethal force. The question is, are they truly non-lethal? We agree, actually, with Steve Tuttle, a spokesperson for Taser International, who told the Orlando Sentinel in July 2002 that there is, quote, a very real risk of death. And Mr. Tuttle told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in May 2004 that the numbers of deaths will increase with the number of devices we sell. And that's a direct quote from the Journal-Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So our position is very simple. We simply say, thus far, Taser International has tested tasers in a systematic way on a pig and five dogs. We are simply calling for independent, full-scale, systematic tests of this device to determine whether or not there may be categories of people, perhaps people with certain kind of heart conditions, perhaps people under the use of certain drugs, whether there are certain categories of people, whether there are certain circumstances under which TASER use should be limited. We think that that would be good for everybody involved, and we think that TASER International ought to be the first to call for that in light of the fact that, as you said in your opening segment, there have been at least 50 deaths associated with the use of TASER since 2001, six of them in June alone.
So you're primarily focused on a safety risk here, the possibility that the TASER use might not end up being non-lethal. What about use in general? Do you have concerns about overuse, about abuse of the TASER, even when it proves, in fact, to be non-lethal, as it typically does?
Well, there is no question, as Professor Klinger said earlier, that these types of devices, not just the TASERs, but other kinds of electroshock weapons, stun batons, for example, stun belts, that these kind of devices do have the potential for misuse. In large measure, they do not leave marks on the body as a baton does, or certainly a gun. And we have documented with the use of electroshock weapons, such as stun guns and stun batons, we have regularly documented their misuse, both by police and prison authorities in this country and elsewhere around the world. TASER also has suggested that they may soon want to sell these devices to the general public, and that civilians may have access to these, and obviously that is a cause for considerable concern as well.
David Klinger, what about police department policies on TASER use? Can you give us a sense of the range of policies about when and what circumstances TASERs are permitted to be used by different departments, and what about multiple tasing, as our policeman Dave Ogden described in Florida?
Right. In terms of the first thing, basically what we talk about in terms of police officers' use of force in general, the police are only allowed to use that force that is reasonably necessary to accomplish a legitimate police task. And the way that we determine that is by gauging the police action based upon what the suspect is doing. And so when I talked about passive noncompliance, that's a very low level of threat on the part of a citizen. Then we move up to what we might have combative noncompliance. Someone is threatening the officer, I'm going to kick your ass, or whatever it might be, some more firm language. And then up to physical attacks, so on and so forth. And in the United States, some agencies have allowed the use of the TASER at these lower levels of force. So
we read in Kansas City about a 9-year-old girl who was tased, about a 66-year-old woman who was hit with a TASER for honking too much or something like that.
It's a little bit more complicated than that in Kansas City.
And
I'm actually working with the city to try to review things and get it a little bit get their procedures and policies in line with what's happening around the country, because Kansas City and some of those agencies that allow the TASER at the lower levels are those that are sort of in the extreme, because most agencies are saying you've got to go one step higher to some sort of evidence that there's about to be an attack or there's an attack, and that's where the TASER is going to be used. And so I think what's happening, as I mentioned before, is we're sort of sorting this stuff out. It's a new technology. Anytime a new technology comes into any sort of social environment, it takes some time to figure out exactly how to use it, and really how to use it in a way that the public is going to agree, because after all, the cops do work for us, for the citizens.
And what about the example you raised of someone saying to a cop, I'm going to kick your hind end?
Right.
I don't know if that's considered, an actionable threat by police, but are police using this on citizens who are just simply mouthing off, who in the old days might have just walked away or been given an angry look?
Well, if they're using them under the circumstances where there's no reasonable way, where a reasonable police officer would say that there's no real threat there, then they shouldn't be using it. But I go 6'4", I'm about 215 pounds.
Yeah.
And if I threaten an officer who's 5'8", 140, and I say, I'm going to do this to you, I would construe that to be a reasonable threat. And at that point, it makes sense under police guidelines to go ahead and use the TASER, because I could injure that individual. Not to mention the fact that his or her only option at that point might be to pull up the nightstick and hit me. And if it gets really bad, he's going to have to shoot me. And so what we're able to do with the TASER is short circuit, pardon the pun there, but short circuit this whole process where it might escalate to a fairly serious use of force. Then getting to your second question about multiple tasing, if in fact it is legitimate to tase an individual one time, they continue to be combative, then we would apply the TASER a second time. And as the lieutenant said, at that point, hopefully we would have sufficient officers on hand to go ahead and handcuff the suspect, get them under control so that the threat isn't is no longer presenting itself.
So, William Schultz, new technology and policing changes. It's happened again and again. What exactly, then, are you asking for? You're asking for more studies on the health risks or the danger, the potential lethality in some circumstances of the taser, and you're asking for police departments to review their rules around the use?
Well, exactly. We're asking not for more studies. We're asking for one serious study. There haven't been any. The British Medical Society has indicated that this is not a safe weapon, that it is not a non-lethal weapon under certain circumstances. We want to know what those circumstances are. We believe that either an independent academic or medical or governmental authority ought to conduct systematic tests on these, and let's find out what the truth is. That can't hurt anybody, and it can only lead to greater wisdom with regard to what kind of guidelines do need to be put in place for the use of these weapons. That's what we do with all new weapons, and why not do it with these?
You mentioned earlier Steve Tuttle with the Taser International Incorporated company. He joins us now from Scottsdale, Arizona. He's Vice President of Communications there. Steve Tuttle, good evening and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
So you've taken some public press drubbing in the last few days. New York Times put out a big story putting out the number of 50 deaths after tasering since 2001 and 6 in June. Here we have William Schultz, head of Amnesty International USA, saying all we've got is a test on a pig and 5 dogs. It's not enough. Taser International needs to do more. What do you say, Steve?
Well, that's a mouthful there to answer back. There's several inaccuracies in some of the statements here. We didn't just zap Porky Pig in the backyard and say, wow, it works great. I mean, in all seriousness, these animal tests that we conduct with medical protocols at the University of Missouri were rather extensive over a 3-day period with 192 discharges of the advanced taser, and that's 14,000 pulses going into these animals directly into the heart, trying to find, you know, if we could defibrillate these animals.
Defibrillate meaning stop or disrupt their heart in a lethal fashion.
Absolutely. And we did this in ways that can't even possibly occur in a field. We opened up the chest walls. We placed the probes directly in places known to be susceptible to electrical current directly on the heart tissue. We could not do that. Again, you're talking 14,000 electrical pulses over 3 days. We did this in other animal studies that are under peer review right now, so it's a little misleading to say just with one dog and a few, you know, of several dogs. This was done over many, many days. And we also introduced drugs into the systems of these animals, and these are small animals which make them more susceptible than humans for electrical stimulation. We introduced isoproterenol, ketamine, things like that to make the heart more susceptible to electrical stimulation, and we couldn't do it. So we've tested this extensively. What Amnesty International is looking for is an independent test. We have provided the independent test, and people are ignoring the Police Scientific Development Branch studies from the United Kingdom, where they do have tasers in 5 of the cities, including the London Metropolitan Police. We've also had this test in Australia at hospitals. We've had this test by the Swiss National Police. These are independent tests. The taser's not funding those. And we get criticized for funding for our tests just as if we were a pharmaceutical company which is going to test their own products. And we've done the testing. We are open to more testing. We've never had the bunker mentality to hide away from this. We've even challenged Amnesty International to come up with paying for 50% of the next test, and we will mutually come to agreement on what the protocol should be.
We'll talk more about health, but let me ask you a couple of other things. It's become very popular. How are sales going, and where are future sales headed of tasers, Steve Tuttle?
Well, and this corresponds directly to my statement I made to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We will see our device involved in more in custody deaths because we are being purchased at an enormously high rate. We've had 150% growth this year, 100% growth before. That is phenomenal given the economy right now. We are at 5,400 police agencies worldwide, including in 40 countries that have also studied this as well. And we will be involved in more and more uses. So, you know, it's an absolute phenomenon that what we're doing in law enforcement is that we're providing the missing tool in the toolbox.
And what about moving on to civilian use and sales to non-law enforcement people? Is that on the horizon?
No, we've been selling to the consumer market for 10 years since our company was founded. And we've put in some rather unique systems that make this pretty safe for the public so they don't have to worry about criminals using these. It's actually traceable that if you fire one of our devices, it shoots out confetti that will actually track back to that owner of that device. So it's like leaving 20 to 30 business cards at a crime scene. And guess what? We they've got a decade of use, that they're not being used as crimes of, it's not a weapon of choice for criminals at all.
Steve Tuttle, stand by. I want to welcome from Nashville, Tennessee, John Wixwoe. He's professor of biomedical engineering, physics, and biophysics at Vanderbilt University. He's done extensive research on the judicial uses of the electric chair, so he knows something about voltage. Good evening and welcome, John Wixwoe.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. I know you're up to speed on the debate over the safety of the taser. What's your view? Is it safe? Are some people more vulnerable than others? What's your bottom line?
My bottom line is that I expect there may be people who are more vulnerable to the taser than is generally expected, but the tests have not been done to show that. At least tests that I know of have not been done.
And who would be more vulnerable?
It would be people with certain cardiac abnormalities, with ischemic heart disease, people who've had a heart attack, people with an undiagnosed genetic predisposition for a certain type of cardiac arrhythmia. These are the kind of people that can be killed by unexpected side effects of even over-the-counter medicines.
And what about drug users, John
Mitchell? Drug users, I think there's a very good chance that drug users may have a greater sensitivity to the taser, but I don't think that's been proven.
Cocaine users, for example.
My personal view is that cocaine may have effects. I was looking at the rebuttal posted by Taser on your website a few minutes ago, and they report a study, which I can't find in the literature, that says that cocaine use in dogs did not affect the fibrillation threshold. I haven't seen the specific study that they're referring to, but my
Steve Tuttle says, look, we've tested this, and it's been tested beyond our realm as well, and we're on top of it. Do you agree?
No.
Because?
I don't think that the difficulty is that you can test it on normal people, you can test it on normal dogs, you can test it on anesthetized dogs, and there's going to be some fraction of the population that may not respond in the way you tested. You may be able to simulate that. You have to decide, do you want to take the risk of calling a device safe when, in fact, there may be a population, a fraction of a percent, maybe larger, that is has a propensity for cardiac arrhythmias.
Steve Tuttle, what do you say to those concerns?
Well, I'm a little surprised that John's got that information, that this would make the person more vulnerable than generally expected. That's not what our studies indicate. And we did go above and beyond the call of duty in terms of testing for drug interaction. And we have the study that the cocaine, particularly on canines, did not make the heart more susceptible to electrical shock. We're dealing with a very, very low voltage, amperage at less than 0.004 amps, and the joule output is so low at 0.36 to 1.76 joules per pulse that we're just not even the same zip code of the dangerous level of cardiac defibrillation. And it's just a known level. I mean, throwing in general abnormalities, undiagnosed issues, I don't know how we can satisfy John's concerns on this one other than to continue testing it, continue to show and back up our facts that this is not going to cause problems for cardiac tissue.
John Wixwell?
It's certainly not going to damage a pacemaker, and we've not seen it to show interference with drugs.
John, last word goes to you.
Twice you have said that this is not anywhere in the league of defibrillation. The issue is not defibrillation, which might be 40 joules, but it is in the league possibly of fibrillation, which can be a fraction of a joule if properly timed. The issue is obviously it doesn't work and cause fibrillation every time. What fraction of the time will it cause fibrillation? And I believe that it needs further study.
Sounds like there's a debate to go on there. John Wixwoe at Vanderbilt and Steve Tuttle at Taser International, thanks for being with us tonight. William Schultz and David Klinger, please stay with us. We are talking about tasers and the use and misuse of non-lethal police force. You can join us. Could your heart handle the zap of a taser? Does the threat of non-lethal force keep criminals in line or cow citizens interacting with police? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about tasers and the use and misuse of non-lethal police force. Taser sales to police forces especially are booming. Since 2001, they have been used 150,000 times by the company's count, the manufacturer's count, on human beings. So what do you say? Are you happy? The police now have a debilitating weapon shy of a gun. In a pinch, isn't it better to tase than to shoot? Or are you worried that the taser will be misused? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Matt is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Yes, my main concern is that of misuse. Unlike pepper spray, other types of non-lethal devices, a taser does not, from my understanding, a taser does not leave any type of physical
mark or evidence on the body, you mean to say?
Correct. Thank you. And so that, I think, makes it a weapon that in the wrong hands could easily be misused, and the victim might not be able to prove that that type of thing even happened.
So what kind of misuse are you imagining?
Well, every once in a while, there are stories of police officers who use inappropriate force in situations. There was the whole Rodney King thing.
It happens.
Right, it happens. And I just am afraid that with the use of tasers and with the fact that they're selling at such a high rate, I think that's just inviting the ability to misuse them.
Matt, thanks for your call. David Klinger, what do you say to our caller from Milwaukee?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One of them is that if, in fact, you shoot somebody with the taser, that is, you fire the barbs and it goes into them, there will definitely be a mark.
That's if it pierces the skin.
Right.
Though it doesn't have to pierce the skin, as I understand.
Well, there's the touch mode and there's the stun mode and then the shoot mode. But I'm talking about if, in fact, someone shoots if an officer shot a citizen with the taser, it would, in fact, show up. The other thing is my understanding of the technology is every time that the taser is activated, there is a record of that in that taser. And so you would have to have some sort of a cover-up. So if a police officer misuses it, doesn't report it, takes his taser back to his sergeant, the sergeant looks at it, and lo and behold, it's been used,
mm-hmm.
He's going to be in trouble. So it's basically, I think that's a bit of a not really the issue. The big issue is, do you have officers that are misusing force? So I think that Taser has done a pretty darn good job of building in a technology that will allow for appropriate monitoring. So I'm not particularly worried about that. But what my bigger concern is, we've been spending a lot of time talking about issues of lethality,
yes.
And that is that let us assume even that we do have this small number of people who are susceptible to death from the Taser. And let's say that what it is every year we're going to have 5 unexpected deaths from the Taser in,
mm-hmm.
in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no way we can predict who's going to have it because a police officer can't say, oh, gee, are you high on cocaine right now? Do you have heart arrhythmia? Whatever the case might be.
Right, right.
On the other hand, what we do is we have 50 people who don't get shot by lethal bullets by the police across the country because the Taser is used. What we have to do is we have to think about a cost-benefit analysis, and the folks at Amnesty need to look at that long and hard. Let's say half of these 50 people that are shot with lethal rounds or who were not shot would have died. So now what I've got is I've got a 5-to-1 ratio of lives saved versus lives lost to the Taser gun.
And yet,
we need to think about.
I guess so, and yet there we're sort of treating lives as interchangeable, but of course each one is individual. William Schultz, what do you make of the moral calculus that David Klinger is describing there?
Well, look, if we have more information about who may be vulnerable, then there are, at least within some circumstances, limitations and guidelines that can be established. A police officer may not know for certain, of course, that somebody is high on drugs, but often those individuals will demonstrate certain behaviors that would lead the officer to believe that that's a possibility. If we determine that someone who is high on cocaine is more likely to result in to die as a result of the use of Taser, then the police officer, there ought to be a protocol established that tasers would be lower down on the list of weapons that would be weapons of first choice. Pepper spray or something else might be used initially. All that we're saying is that this is a new device. This is a new technology. In many ways, it's an unregulated technology. It's fallen between the cracks. It's not a gun on the one hand, and it's not a mere fly swatter on the other. We believe that there ought to be clear protocols established, tracking and monitoring their use, and let's see what the results bring us.
Let's hear from our callers. Jay is calling from Horicon, Wisconsin. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Great, thanks. Great.
I know that a lot of police stations or police departments have upgraded their handguns over the years because of fail-to-stop type situations. You shoot somebody, they still come at you and take the gun away and use it on you. Has that ever happened with a taser? Has anyone ever taken it away from a police officer and used it on them?
David Klinger.
I do not know if they have been taken away and used on them. I do know that there have been cases where suspects have attempted to disarm officers, have taken the taser away, and then the officers have used deadly force against them prior to being shot with the taser, similar to the chemical agents that officers sometimes carry.
Along those same lines, what about Taser International says they're selling lots to civilians. Does that concern police departments in the same way that some assault rifle sales concern police departments? Clearly not the same level of lethality, but are they worried about them being used back the other way?
I have not really heard of any police organizations expressing that worry. So that's all I can tell you about it, sir.
Sandra's calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Sandra. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, my concern was the one you just mentioned. If first, I think we're probably talking about a whole class of weapons rather than just one weapon. And just because we have one company say they do this doesn't mean that another company won't build something that does it a little differently. And my concern is if we can make them here in this country, they'll make them in other countries. If police officers have them, criminals will have them, and terrorists and who knows will have them. And you know, what kind of a problem is that? I have one more point, which is that they have been misused. At the trade talks in Miami last winter, they were used against student protesters, nonviolent student protesters.
That's
Thank
interesting.
You.
Thanks very much for your call, Sandra. William Schultz, what about the use here in a context of political protest? You don't have to use lethal force. Have you seen circumstances where civil liberties, public expression have been curtailed through taser use? The question seems relevant, particularly with the big national political conventions coming up.
Well, we have not demonstrated that with regard to the use of tasers, but we certainly have in the past demonstrated that with regard to the use of other kinds of electroshock weapons. Electroshock weapons are notoriously misused by police and prison officials, both in this country and around the world. There need to be very severe limits placed on the export of these kind of weapons as well, because these are the types of weapons that governments and police authorities that are notorious for torture are more than delighted to get their hands on.
And David Klinger, just looking at use again, they have 21-foot wires, so this is a weapon that can be widely used, but still it's not a distance weapon. You've got to be in close proximity to whoever you're firing at.
Yes, you do, but that's actually an advantage because what we're trying to do with the taser and with a lot of other things in law enforcement is avoid what we call going hands-on. That is, having to tie up with someone, getting into a grappling match where the danger lies. So if what I can do is I can stay 10, 12, 15 feet away from you, you're threatening me, I decide the threat gets to a point where I need to tase you, I can get you onto the ground and get you handcuffed without having to engage in a fight with you. Mm-hmm. And the 21-foot wire, basically that's the distance that we want to keep officers away from people who are armed with edge weapons, baseball bats, so on and so forth. So if I can stay about 20 feet away from you and you've got a knife and you say, I'm about to cut you, and you start to step towards me, many situations like that are going to end with police gunfire. And if I can shoot you with a taser gun, what I can do is I can get you on the ground, and now I don't have to shoot you with my sidearm. So, yes, it's a close proximity weapon, but that's the distance at which most encounters between citizens and officers occur anyway.
How do you think this might change those encounters in policing over time? Will it make it more likely that police will put hands on, though from a distance, via the wires of a taser? Is it more likely that they'll apply force rather than, I don't know, talk someone down or come to some negotiated verbal settlement?
Well, I think that probably there will be more usage of the taser. More force would be used, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And once again, this gets into the cost-benefit thing. Let's say I've got a SWAT situation where I've got five SWAT officers, and I've got two of them with lethal firearms, two with tasers, and one who's what we call our hands man, who's going to handcuff them. The negotiations aren't going anywhere. We can negotiate till the cows come home, or what we can do is we can make a decision. Look, we're going to go ahead and tase this guy, get him into custody. And if I do that 50 times and I don't have to shoot anybody, that's great. But what about if I don't do that, the 49th time the guy charges me with the knife, my two guys shoot him with the lethal weapons, now I've got a dead suspect. So it's one of those things where, in my mind, sometimes using more force is actually the more humane thing. When I say more force, I mean using the taser versus
using
nothing.
William Schultz, we've just got half a minute left, but that makes it sound as though Americans may have to or may get used to this kind of force being used more frequently as a matter of policing efficiency.
Well, that has already been demonstrated in some of the departments that have been using tasers, that indeed there is more a higher degree of use of force with the tasers than there had been previously. That's obviously of concern.
Well, this conversation is clearly going to be one that goes on. Let's hope that everybody can avoid the taser on either end. William Schultz, thank you very much for being with us tonight. William Schultz, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, and David Klinger, Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, author of Into the Kill Zone, A Cop's Eye View of Deadly Force. Thank you so much for your time and thoughts tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. In a moment, one Boston woman says she'll stick around when the Democrats take over her city next week. This is On Point. Boston resident Tiziana Deering was thinking about skipping town next week during the Democratic National Convention. Terror alerts, extra security measures, the threats of attack all filled her with foreboding, especially when her thoughts turned to her 2-year-old daughter. But in this radio diary, she explains why she's decided to stick around Boston next week, after all.
I had no idea how much absolute love is tied to absolute fear. But now that I have a child in the age of terror, I'm learning. I've always had an irrational fear of being separated from my husband during some awful event and not being able to get back to him. When September 11th happened, I was 4 months pregnant. Sitting in Baltimore watching the towers come down, I realized it was actually happening. Terror had struck, and there was no way I could get home to Boston. I didn't see my husband again for 3 days. My fear was galvanized. It became a permanent, palpable companion. In the months that followed, I got my fear back under control by focusing on our capability, the fact that Steve and I are adults. We can survive on our own and would always keep trying to get back to each other if we got separated. But then my daughter was born, and the whole game changed. It's not just about separation anymore. It's about protection. Simone is 2. She isn't an adult. She can't take care of herself. And if tragedy struck and we got separated, she couldn't keep trying to get back to us. It's my job to protect her, and sometimes when I look at her smile or kiss that soft, pudgy little cheek, the thought of not being able to do that makes me crazy. What if I can't get to her? I work several miles from my daughter's daycare and rely on roads and highways to reach her that would be hopelessly clogged or completely shut down if an attack happened. What if? That permanent, palpable companion is back. I'm really scared. I know this is a time for stoicism and defiance. I know that my responsibility as a citizen is to brazenly go about my daily life. But I also know how much I love my daughter, and how much the desire to be with her and keep her safe seems to trump pretty much everything else. Still, we're not leaving town during the convention, and I'm not taking off work. I could, but we already have vacation plans for another time, and doing it just to assuage my fear is a fool's errand. It won't change the fact that as a parent, I have to learn to live with a lifetime of not being able to protect her. The terror threat just gives that realization some pretty potent immediacy. So, I'm learning to deal with a new grade of panic, and I'm getting it under control. I'm learning to breathe out the knots in my stomach over news reports and orange alerts, and I only turn around and give one extra kiss and hug now when I hear, "Bye-bye, Mommy." And hard as it is, the effort is worth it. Because when she looks at me or plops a 2-year-old kiss on my cheek, I understand how much absolute love is absolutely worth the fear.
Tiziana Deering lives in Boston. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.